look at three categories of missionaries, which are one simple way of dividing the type of missionaries that are needed. General missionaries are those that can lead to church planting opportunities most easily. Now, it's very helpful to have a profession, a skill or profession which foreign governments recognize. And it may be possible for you to go as a tent maker. You don't need to, or you will not be able to go as a traditional missionary in closed countries or limited access countries. But these are the sort of skills. Medical, of course, is always most places desirable. Doctors, dentists, ophthalmologists, nurses, public health and nutrition, particularly public health. Now in America there are hospitals or universities which give training in public health as a separate type, and that's what I recommend. If some of you are interested in what sort of medicine is most useful overseas, public health. Now it has a bad connotation in America. It's usually regarded as the welfare, the rundown, the inner city type medical work. Well, that's not bad, because you will learn to deal with real problems and not just some of the sophisticated areas of suburban America where people are suffering from their own overindulgence and excesses. So public health medicine, nursing or doctors are very helpful. But probably more important than medicine, although the most Americans don't recognize it, is agriculturalists are the most useful. In fact, I heard a doctor himself say that one good agriculturalist is worth 10 doctors. Doctors only add to the problem of malnutrition, because there are already too many people and not enough food. But an agriculturalist who can grow more food can really be a tremendous asset. And in many countries, especially in the cattle herding nomad people amongst whom I've lived most of my life, veterinary care, veterinarians are the most prized of all. They have a very valued skill. Horticulturalists and soil specialists, those are the people that can deal with more of the detail. Agriculturalists, especially range management agriculture. I think I've just about persuaded my son to go into range management, because it is a type of agriculture which is most useful for people who are grazing cattle on wide open spaces. It has an application in this country, but it's particularly useful in third world countries. And forestry is surprisingly useful. A lot of countries who are realizing that they've cut down so many forests, they've got to begin reforestation. Enlightened countries know that when you cut a tree down, you should always plant two. Most African countries have not considered that, because they're out for all they can get. Just tear down these huge mahogany forests, all these exotic ebony forests, and never bother to replant. And so now it is going to have to take a lot of reforestation. So that's going to be a valued type of agriculture. And finally, I've put in here engineering. Civil is certainly the most important, the most useful. Auto mechanics are always valuable. Mechanical. Water resources is particularly useful. Simple. Third world type, low-tech water development. Now, I know that there's not many of you here in that category yet, but I go a lot of times to state or secular universities, state schools, where you get a lot more of these sort of people. And they haven't got any Bible, but they've got their professional skills. So you're in a different situation from them, but it may be useful if you are going to go into further training for you to say, well, I always did want to be a nurse, or I was always interested in agriculture, to decide, yes, that would be the most useful thing for me to do. So that's why I give you this, to know where would you be advised to train if you want to be of use in the third world. Then, specialists and service opportunities are those who are not directly on the front line. The other ones, those first ones, can lead directly to a people sort of ministry that will get you into a church planting situation. These specialist functions are really important. In no way second rate or second class. These are people that are technical people usually, support people. communications, be radio engineers and producers, artists, writers, drama, music. There is a tremendous push on right now for high quality Christian radio. I know it's all over America, and I'm just amazed. I spin my little dial on my Sony, how many Christian radio stations there are. More than any other station. You find these Christian stations all over the dial. But in third world countries, and in closed countries, and in Eastern Bloc countries, China, radio is the vital role. And the five major Christian radio broadcasts, like the HCJB and Radio Elwer, the main Christian overseas broadcast shortwaves, have agreed together that they, by the year 2000, will broadcast in every language where there are more than 1 million people. That's a massive increase in their broadcasting. And it's going to need a lot of technical people and writers, musicians, who are prepared to live and work overseas. If we could just push out some of these highly skilled, gifted people who are competing against one another in this country. How many Christian musicians are running around this country entertaining the saints? They could be wonderfully used in a vital ministry where the gospel goes into closed countries. Because it's amazing the number of countries that want to learn English, hear English song, want to learn English style music. So music is important these days. Teaching, now that may particularly be relevant to some of you here, especially in schools for missionaries' children. Let me talk a bit more about those. These are the all-important support function for parents who are out there in the remote areas who are doing the frontline job. Their children have to go away to school. Now, I know to most Americans that sounds the most terrible thing you could possibly do. I assure you, it is not bad at all. If it's done with a good attitude and with a realization that this is where you learn to trust God for your kids. You commit them to Him. I went to boarding school in England. It was a great honor. I won a scholarship at 11 to go to boarding school for 7 years. And I look upon it as probably one of the finest things that ever happened. It was really a beneficial thing. I agree it's more difficult to send your kids to school at 6, which is when ours all had to go to school. But we raised those kids with the realization that because of the nature of our work, where we lived, they could not go to school with us. My wife tried to teach them because in England we all start school at 4. So she would try and teach them when they were 4 or 5 how to, the elementary stuff. But by 6 they were ready for school. And we have no regrets. And the children say, yes, it was tough in the first year or two, but they are so grateful. They know that we didn't send them because we didn't love them. It's the important thing, as a child knows, that they're not going because you just can't be bothered with them, because they interfere with your ministry, but because it's best for them. And there's nothing harder than to see a mission station where half the kids or three quarters of the kids go away to school, and the poor ones that have to stay home with mother teaching them, it can create terrible strains, because the kids go to school, have such fun, it's like being with your friends all the time, and they have such a fellowship, such a commitment. In fact, the greatest struggle my kids have is when they come back and have to try and relate to the average American teenager. They can't understand how these friendships are so shallow. When they've been in school, they have such deep, deep friendships. They're with them all the time, all through the day, in their games after school, in the dormitories at nights. They have such close friendships. And they come here and they find people who they think are very friendly, but the next day they can't even remember their name. And it gives this realization of how shallow is relationships, our relationships in this country. And our kids really struggle with that. They have to adjust to the fact that young people over here do not really know what a close friendship is. It's always, especially with girls, such in and out and best friends today and you're all off tomorrow. That's really hard. But the teachers in those schools are more than teachers. They have to love those kids like the parents. There's all sorts of need for extracurricular activities in sports and drama and music. After school, the teachers spend a lot of time with the kids, and that's when the good relationships go on. In some schools, A dorm parent is just a dorm parent. They are there when the child finishes school, they come back to their dormitory, and the dorm parent is like mother. Often they are mothers of their own two or three young children who have this extended family, and that's very healthy. It gives quite a atmosphere of family when the dorm parent has their own little children. But that is a real wonderful role if you've got a heart of love and love children and love to be more than just a teacher, love to spend time with them and listen to them. Yeah, well, her husband is the fifth grade teacher, but she is teaching typing and I think it's art, I think she's doing. And my daughter went to one of these schools. She was the oldest one, so she was the one that had to go first. It's always easier for the later kids because they have a big sister or a big brother at school. But just to show that there's no resentment and no bitterness at all against that experience, my daughter Marion went out this August, last August, to go back to the same school where she started off. Incidentally, she arrived in the country on her birthday, 24 years from the day when she first arrived in Ethiopia. So she made her second advent. But she is a dorm parent of just five kids. That's a very small dorm. But it's just coming out of a period of real uncertainty when there were very few missionaries with children in Ethiopia. And so they're just reopening the dormitory. And those kids live with them like a family. She has to cook their meals and send them off to school, get their clothes washed, and when they come home, she's there for them. So it is, they sleep like kids would in any home. So she has an instant family of five kids. They've only been married for a year, so it's quite an experience for them. But as I was saying, it is much more than a teacher. You can teach, or some schools they won't let you teach. You're just a dorm parent. There's another role for single girls who are mature and not too old. I mean, usually about between 25 and 35, there's a real need for single girls who are going to go and be dorm parents for the teenage girls. Because the older girls in these schools do not apparently get on well with married ladies. It's much easier for them to relate to a single girl. And so they usually, in the high school girls group, it's single ladies that are the dorm mothers. And boy, that is an act of real love and kindness, because you've got to listen to all these crazy girls with all their emotional problems and their boyfriends and everything else, and you spend hours and hours with these girls. I really admire those who are prepared to take on the teenage girls, the high school age girls. So you have the younger kids, and the boys usually have married couples as dorm parents, then the teenage girls usually have single girls as their dorm mothers, because that makes more peace that way. Then, in government schools, I mentioned that one, there are a surprising number of countries where they follow the old British system, especially in the ex-colonial countries, of having Bible or religious education in schools. And so every day there's a class in every grade for Bible. And the government is wide open to qualified teachers, and they will usually take Cape and Ray Bible School, as in some countries is enough to qualify you to teach Bible. They would prefer to have a teaching qualification, some sort of teaching diploma. But it depends how urgent they are and how far you're prepared to go away from the capital city. Because usually the government can get teachers to teach in the big cities. But in the rural areas and in the hot and nasty places, government teachers are hard to get. They don't like to go there. And if people are missionaries prepared to go for the sake of the gospel, they are usually welcome in those less congenial places. English and Bible are the main subjects. And certainly for English teachers, there is a great demand. But you should have the proper qualification of teaching English as a second language. There are special courses taught in many places. And then the other specialist functions, really important. You can never get enough of these. The secretaries, the accountants, the bookkeepers, house parents, hospitality. People who can just prepare to go and serve others. Most missions have headquarters where people come up from down country. They're sick, they're tired, they need love, they need to be welcomed at any time of the day and night, they need a lot of patient handling. And that's a real ministry of a servant heart. People who will be hospitality, housekeepers, bookkeepers, and secretaries. They're hard to find because churches don't like to support a secretary. I think that's unspiritual. It is a very needy role. Okay, well, the more specialized people, linguists. Now, you've all heard of Wycliffe Bible Translators. That is one organization, WBT, that stands for Wycliffe Bible Translators. TESL is Teaching English as a Second Language. That's the important qualification you will need. These are skills that you probably know whether you have them or not. Believe it or not, the best linguists are not people who are talkers, but mathematicians. It takes a mathematical mind to analyze a language. So for Bible translation, a mathematical mind is very useful. If you have one of those, you may well be suited for that. And when Wycliffe Bible Translation is recruiting people, that's how they evaluate them, is how good they are mathematically, because they will almost certainly be a good Bible translation. They may never be a very good preacher or communicator. That isn't important. It's to have a good, sharp, analytical mind. And then you get these rare people who are the pilots and mechanics, radio and electronics technicians. When I was at Moody last week, they have a lot of aspiring pilots up there. They have an aviation program. And they, all these young men, think it's a very glamorous, dramatic profession. It is the most boring job on the mission field. You have to be some incredible saint with all the patience in the world. It is no glamour job. It's like running a milk run most of the time. And as I've watched, the people we've worked with most of our lives have been these MAF pilots. That we saw more of them than anybody else. And we realize how few people are really suitable for that role. You don't need to be a brilliant pilot. It helps to keep you alive a lot longer if you are a good pilot. But more than anything else, you need to have infinite patience. We've watched that when they are about to fly an African family, for instance, here's an evangelist going to go down to some way outpost, some distant airstrip. And the pilot arrives already 10 minutes late, and he's got 4 or 5 more places to go to that day. And so he's in a rush. And there's the evangelist waiting, and he has his 4 chickens and 2 pots of honey, and everybody keeps on bringing these gifts at the last minute, and the pilot is loading these in as carefully as he can. And then when it comes time to get into the plane, then the African has to say goodbye to all the 60, 70 people who've come to see him off. And saying goodbye in Africa is kissing somebody on both cheeks 4, 5, 6 times. Every one of them. And if you miss one, then you've offended them. And so you watch the pilot. And he says, why can't they say goodbye before I arrive? Well, you don't. And so you've watched the pilot get more and more frustrated. And in the end, he looks at his watch and he grabs the poor guy. And when he's already said goodbye to 4 or 5 people, and he pushes him in the plane, he's angry. Everybody's offended. And it's remembered forever. That man there, he's so rude. Well, of course, the African doesn't understand that this guy has a precise flight schedule, that he has to get 5 more places in or 10 more in before 5:30, because he must be on the ground at his final destination before sundown. And that's the time. It gets dark every time in Africa. By 6 o'clock, you must be on the ground, so he aims to be on the ground at 5:30. If you're not, then you're in serious trouble. And so that's the pressures they work under. And I've watched these guys that may be brilliant pilots blow it because you need to have all the patience in the world. Doesn't matter how clever you are. If you're not a great servant, you have a lot of peace and really have know how to handle relationships. So that's enough about pilots, but they're very important people. And then the most specialist of all are church planting and evangelism. People who have no other skill, they aren't professional, anything. But there are still some countries where you can go as a church planting missionary. You can get a visa for a church planting missionary for Kenya. You can't get one for veterinarian. The government says, we have enough veterinarians, but there's always room for missionaries. And so that's an anomaly. Same in Liberia. You can go as a missionary. And of course, there's always a role for good missionary wives and mothers. And if you'd like to apply, we'll put a list on here and the guys can come and sort them through. Any applicants for the job of missionary wives and mothers, there's always a good need for them. Any questions? Okay, well, I just... This may not be of interest to you, but just for your information. I don't know if you can even read it. It's the green ink seems to have faded badly. Just briefly, what do foreign missions look like? Well, basically, there are three different types of agencies. Denominations, like the Presbyterians and the Baptists, they are the biggies. They've got the power, they've got the money, they've got a lot of church backing behind them. There are 37,000 Baptist churches, Southern Baptist churches, and so they have an awful lot of influence and money, a multi-million dollar program. They run most of the institutions, like hospitals, colleges, serving their churches or only establishing their brand of church in already evangelized areas, and that's the problem. They seem to think that if there's... There may well be three other flavors of Baptists, but if there's not their particular brand of Bible-believing, orthodox, left-handed Baptists, we've got to have our brand there. And that's how it often works. It has to be exactly that particular denomination. And especially Presbyterians, they'll often find three Presbyterian churches that are now, the different brands of Presbyterians. They seem to like to straighten out the other ones slightly deviant theology. So that's why you get these different competing denominations. But there's no doubt about it. They have been very effective over many years. Short and long term is possible, but some require 3-year seminary for long term. So it's a long haul. You'd have to go and get a college degree and you go to seminary before you'd be acceptable to the Southern Baptists, for instance. The finances come from the denomination. You don't need to raise support. Once you're in, they pay you a nice, handsome salary, and you get everything taken care of. Then the other group to which I belong is the interdenominational or faith missions. There's no particular church backing behind this, no denominational backing. Individual churches. Most begin as frontier missions for evangelism and church planting of neglected areas. And that's where most of these mission agencies came, because the denominations were not going. So a few visionaries set off and try and find unreached people. And some of these have become very large too. Like Wycliffe Bible Translators. They have about 5,000 or 6,000 missionaries now. Very large. The main ones would be like SIM, OMF. The OMF stands for Overseas Missionary Fellowship. They work in Asia. They usually work geographically. All skills needed for short or long term, most advise some Bible school training. They would require Bible school. Usually 1 year, Cape Inner Bible School is considered adequate, unless you're going to go and teach in a seminary level, upper level school. And they would require more. Now, finances, in these, you have to raise your own support. Now, that's what scares some people off. Would I have to raise my support? And that seems to deter some people very much. Well, you have to believe that if God is the one who calls you, He's going to have to supply your needs. And it's some people would never accept it because they say, it looks like begging. Fine, if that's your problem, then you need to resolve that one with God. But it is a very biblical position that the church will support the people whom they send. If your church hasn't sent you, then of course it is difficult. That's why it's much more important to get churches behind you in prayer before you ever think of going. And then finally, short-term or parachurch agencies, OM, that means Operation Mobilization, Youth with a Mission, Campus Crusade, International Crusades. Their goal is evangelism, not primarily church planting, good for short-term exposure and getting experience. I can hardly read that myself. Finances mixed, but usually bring your own is what the OM would say. You have to raise a certain minimum amount of money, and then they'll look after you. So those are the main different sorts of agencies that are operating. Have we finished? Let's turn this heat off. Any questions? Go ahead, Bobby. After you've gone and seen some short term, I think it's fine, but I do recommend that you would go for a short term, preferably 1 year, up to 2 years, or at least 3 months, until you see what your gifts are and what you really would like to do. There's so many people that go to seminary because that's just the normal thing, and when they get there, they never use it. It's unnecessary. Seminary teaches you to answer the problems of this society. When you go overseas, there are very different questions. So many societies don't have the same problems as America. They're not interested in, so you're learning the wrong answers. But if you know what the questions are, then you can come back. And you may find if you go overseas for a year or 2 years, that it would be much more useful if you had some practical qualification like a 3-year degree in agriculture, or get some more practical training rather than theological training. But if you're going to teach in a Bible school or in overseas upper level education, then you would need to have a seminary degree, and usually a master's level. Anything else? Okay, well, I've finished my stuff. I'm going to just tell you one story and then I'll leave you early. The story I just going to mention was I talked about the Podi people. They were this tribe who lived in the bend of the river Omo, the northwest corner of that province. They have a sad record of being the most aggressive murdering people. And it is for them a survival because their cattle are being wiped out by sleeping sickness. It's come into their valley. Sleeping sickness is carried by a tsetse fly, a fly which is really a pesky beast that it just lands. Have you ever seen tsetse flies? You have them in the States? I hope not. They bite you viciously. But they don't affect human beings in East Africa. They do in West Africa. But in East Africa, they carry a disease which causes sleeping sickness in the cattle. And once that disease comes in, it marches forward about 3 miles a year. Those flies advance and the disease moves with them. And so once it hits your area, those people don't understand what's happened. Their cows just keep dying. They don't know it's the fly which is bringing the disease. So while our cows are dying, you are doomed, because if you have no cows, then you will have no means of buying a wife. You have nothing to eat or drink if blood is your main diet. So that is why these Podi people have developed a very aggressive attitude towards anybody around them. They've got to keep on getting cattle to replenish their dying herds. Well, in order to get to their main raiding ground, their enemy tribes are across the other side of the river, most of them. They're called the Kulukonta people, who are the victims of the Podi. Well, the Podi want to cross that river, Omo. It's a river filled with crocodiles. And they don't swim too well, because you don't take swimming lessons in a river filled with crocodiles. So they have to get across that river somehow. Well, there are no bridges and no boats, so they have developed a particular skill using a goat skin. Well, they take an average goat, and they cut the poor animal's head off, which I'm sure the goat doesn't appreciate. But then even worse, they start to pull all the innards of the goat through the neck hole, including all the bones, the ribs, and everything, right down to the feet. So when they're left with, you've got this empty skin with only hole being the neck, and everything has come out through the neck. All you have are these four little feet hanging down. Even the knee joints, they try and get the bone out there, so there's just the hoof left. The idea is the skin shall not be broken. And of course, you've got the tail at the back end. Well, all of that, I'm sure the goat does not appreciate. Very painful business. But that's only the start of its ignominy and its suffering, because then they take that skin and they boil it and they start to stretch it. And they stretch it and they pound it with smooth stones. They keep pounding that skin till it becomes thinner and thinner and stretches bigger and bigger. Oh, that's painful for the poor goat. But then, when they feel it can stretch no further, then they take that neck hole and they blow the thing off. And they have done their job properly. There will be no puncture at all. The skin will still be unbroken. If they puncture it, it's finished. It's no use. But when they blow this thing up, it can become as big as a balloon, as a largest cow you ever seen, a huge big skin. Now that's what makes the skin useful. Because when they've blown that thing up, they tie off the neck hole and strap it tightly so the air can't escape. And they have this wonderful buoyancy cylinder for going across the river. And they can put, well, you've got these nice little protrusions hanging on the edge, the four legs and the tail and the neck, and they'll put 12, 15 men will hang on around the outside, and they all kick their legs like crazy to keep the crocodiles away. And one man gets on the top, and he steers the whole thing over the other side. He just paddles the thing over. And now he gets safely across the other side. You see, if they didn't stretch the poor old goat skin and just blow it up, it would still be very small, and it might hold one or two people, but they'd probably be eaten by the crocodiles before they get across. So it's the stretching process which makes the goat skin usable. Well, I mention that not to give you some advice about how to cross a river if you haven't got a bridge or a boat, but to illustrate what I think is a very simple principle, that God gives us the privilege of being stretched. Why? Because he has so much more he wants to give us than we can receive of his fullness. The limiting factor in God's ability to give to us is our capacity to receive. And so he gives us the privilege of being stretched. Now, stretching is not nice. It's painful. And some of you may well be going through stretching businesses there. Your faith is being stretched. Your whole attitude to life is being stretched. You've been nice and comfortable. But suddenly you're being tested. And perhaps you're feeling, hey, I don't like this. Well, you have the great advantage over the goat. You can say to God, no, I don't want any more. I've got as much of you as I want, or you've got as much of me as I want you to have. And that's fine. God will not overrule our objections. But who will be the loser? If we want to stay just that big, we will contain that's how much God can give us. But he has always so much more of his fullness that he wants to pour into us. So if we allow him to stretch us, we will gain. If we say, no, God, that's enough. I don't want any more. I've had enough stretching. I'm quite happy to be a sensible, normal Christian and live in Canada or America or Australia, wherever it is. I don't want any more. We will be the losers because God wants always to give us in his love more and more of his fullness that we might enjoy as much as we are able. And there are some people, no doubt, who never will get stretched very far because their vision for what God can give them is limited. They're quite happy to be normal, sensible, 9-to-5 Christians, go to church on Sunday mornings. That's all God will ever have. What I'm saying is that give God his chance to stretch you, whatever it means. It may mean some painful experiences that the old flesh doesn't like. It doesn't like giving up certain things. Maybe you've got certain goals and ambitions or even friendships in your life which you know are hindering God, that are not helpful to you. He gives us the privilege of saying, yes or no, I want to get rid of anything in my life that's going to limit God to use me to the maximum. And it's this stretching which will make you useful. So I leave you with that little illustration that we might always be those who are hungry for all that God has to give. Willing to accept that stretching because we will be blessed in order to be a blessing to others. That's the whole business. Not just for our own satisfaction, but that the world might be satisfied through us and we might truly be the means for his glory to be known all around this world. That the glory of God shall one day cover this whole earth as the waters cover the sea. Let's close in prayer. Father God, I thank you that we understand more and more of how you deal with us in love. Not just to satisfy our own selfish desires, not just to bless us, but that we might be a blessing to others. And Father, right throughout history, we see throughout the Bible so many examples of where you have allowed your people to be stretched beyond comfort, But it seems to be that we only learn anything new about God when it gets to the point of beyond comfort. And so I pray that you might shake us out of our nice little comfort zones, that we might be open-hearted to you, allowing you to do whatever you want, because we know that you love us. And even though the devil tries to convince us that to do your will is going to be painful, it's going to be giving up this and giving up that, help us to see, Lord, that we gain nothing but your love and approval and your blessing. And that this world's goods have nothing to compare with the satisfaction which you delight to give to your people. And so I pray for these students, every one of them. I don't know them very well, but you know each one intimately. All their thoughts and their goals, their ambitions for their lives. Lord, I commit them to you that they might each one discover the joy of being all that you could ever mean them to be. That they might be a blessing. Bless them wonderfully during their time here. Teach them great lessons. May you lead them into your perfect path, wherever that might be. Thank you for this place, and may this time together be a wonderful growing experience as they live together as Christians in a close, small community. But it's a great learning opportunity when we can learn patience and love for one another, even the unlovable, where we can learn to be compatible and to enjoy the body of Christ with all our differences, and not feeling that we in any way are prejudiced, realizing that you love this whole world evenly and equally. Thank you for the lesson this morning from Peter, how he had to learn by such a struggle how much you love all men. Keep on teaching us that sort of lesson, that we shall be humble servants, joyful disciples, willing to follow you anywhere, whatever that might mean. I ask these things in Jesus' mighty name and for his glory. Amen. I thank you very much for this week, for your rapt attention.